Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, I am speaking with Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Animals and Science Policy Institute, Dr. Elizabeth Ormandy. Elizabeth's passion is promoting the replacement of animals in research, testing, and teaching as best scientific practice. Elizabeth, it's really great to have the opportunity to speak with you today about dissection in classrooms. Thank you so much for talking to me.
You are most welcome.
Can we start off just by having you tell us a little bit about Animals and Science Policy Institute, or is it ISPI, the short form? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, ASPI, or Animals and Science Policy Institute.
ASPI, yeah. I see. Okay.
We are a Canadian registered charity. We founded as a nonprofit in 2015, but we got our charitable status in 2017. And we seek to promote better science without animals. One of our core funded projects at the moment is to help teachers replace the use of animals in dissection in their classrooms with non-animal teaching methods. So things like 3D models, virtual dissections, virtual and augmented reality experiences. Anything that's not a real animal that's been killed for the purpose of education.
Elizabeth, just to ask you a few basic questions about dissection, particularly here in Canada. I remember starting dissection in grade 7. Is that still the case? Is that generally the grade where most dissection begins? Or am I not having that stat properly in my head?
No, I think that's about right. So what we found from our survey in 2017 of teachers in British Columbia is that they were reporting dissection in grades 5 through 12, but with the majority starting in grade 8. And so you would be about right if you were in grade 7. There are some teachers that do dissections in grades 5 through 7.
And are the main animals that I remember in the classroom were fetal pigs that were in jars, really. Those were not for dissection, but those were more being shown to us. And then the first dissection that we were actually allowed to, that the first animals were allowed to interact with, were dead frogs. Am I getting that correct, or have things changed? What are the species that are most commonly used in classroom dissections?
So again, according to the survey that we did, the top three species are frogs, rats, and fetal pigs. Okay. But a whole range of species are used for dissection. And so teachers will sometimes use grasshoppers, starfish, animal parts like sheep's hearts or cow's eyes. There's a whole range, but the top three that were reported to us were frogs, rats, and fetal pigs.
Okay. And why should we be thinking of alternatives to dissection as superior? Is that accurate information? I mean, there's a lot of buzz about that, but yet it still seems that dissection is such a prevalent practice.
Mm-hmm. So I think that there are different ways in which non-animal alternatives are superior. And of course, the most important one for teachers is that students simply learn better when they use non-animal methods. And there's empirical evidence to back that up. So I'm a scientist. I believe in evidence. And so it's an empirically testable question about whether students do learn better with non-animal methods versus real animal dissection. And so I was curious about whether anybody had ever actually tested that question. Turns out that we did a literature review and found 62 different studies that had done that direct comparison and evaluated student learning. The way that the data played out was that in 26 of those 62 cases, those 62 studies, non-animal methods were shown to help students achieve their learning outcomes better and retain information over the longer term better.
Wow.
In 28 of 62 cases, the non-animal methods were roughly equivalent to dissection. And in only 8 out of 62 of those studies did dissection show up as being superior to the non-animal teaching methods. But I will say that in a couple of those 8 studies, the methodology was a little dodgy.
And in addition to that, obviously, like from somebody who works in advocacy, and I'm thinking animal welfare, could you just highlight some of the other reasons why non-animal methods are superior, other than just, you know, it actually being better in terms of learning for the student?
Yeah, so they can cost less, I did a cost comparison, and if all teachers switched to non-animal methods in British Columbia, then in the first year, we would save our school science budgets about $250,000. And that's a cost saving that would exponentially increase over time, because the non-animal methods tend to be that they don't carry with them annual fees and no recurring costs. They're the greener option often, so you're not running the risk of throwing away harsh chemicals down the drain from your preserved specimens. They are safer and more inclusive for students. So I remember speaking to a former teacher from New York, who told me about the day that he had to put a scalpel in the hand of the school bully. And this child had a lot of trauma at home. They were very volatile. They acted out in unpredictable and uncontrollable ways. But the teacher didn't want to single them out by not letting them participate. And so it was a nervous moment putting a sharp, pointy thing in the hands of someone who's unpredictable.
I hadn't even thought about that aspect. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that either until he mentioned it. So two really important things that have come up since we started doing this work. So the first is that there are three guiding principles to the ethical use of animals in science. They're called the 3 R's principles: replacement, reduction, and refinement. And replacement simply says that if you can meet your scientific or your educational goals without using animals, then it's our ethical obligation as scientists in the world to not use animals. And so the data that I just told you about the educational merit of non-animal methods shows us that replacement is an ethical obligation in this case, because we can meet our educational goals without using animals. Now, unfortunately, teachers aren't taught about the 3 R's. And so we really need to ramp up 3 R's education for teachers. And the second really important thing that's come up for us is when we are a nation that is really trying hard to undergo reconciliation efforts with First Nations. I've been working with a First Nations educator here in British Columbia, and I asked him about dissection and how that relates to the BC curriculum and the new requirement for teachers to better represent Aboriginal perspectives in the classroom. And even though he's just one individual and he cannot and does not speak on behalf of all First Nations, he is very clear that dissection does not represent him because it doesn't respect animals. And he understands respect for animals to be, don't waste any part of an animal. And he really feels that the use of animals in dissection is wasteful because it's unnecessary. And there's a lack of reverence. So for him, there needs to be a sorry and a thank you for any animal life that's taken.
In terms of numbers of animals, so the numbers of lives that could be saved, do we have any data on that? Is there any accurate way of knowing just how many animals here in Canada, never mind abroad, are used in classroom dissections, or do we not have the data on that?
To my knowledge, we don't have the data. High schools are unregulated in terms of their animal use, so they don't fall under our national oversight agency, the Canadian Council on Animal Care. They don't oversee high schools directly, and so there's no requirement for schools to report the number of animals that they're using for dissections. So as a result, we don't have that data at all. What we can do is kind of guess by saying, well, there's this number of students in a class on average. Let's say conservatively you would have one animal per between 2 and 4 students, and you could do some elaborate math on that, but it's just guessing.
So where are these animals coming from if there's no oversight? It's so ironic kind of that there isn't, because I mean, it should be kind of transparent where schools are collecting these animals from. Could you speak on that a little bit? Are these animals coming from farms? Are they farmed for this purpose? Are they coming from the wild? Where do these animals come from?
It really depends on the species. So you mentioned fetal pigs, and that was your experience. So fetal pigs are often, I think, wrongfully called byproducts of the food production system. The reason I don't like that terminology is that I've worked in the farming world as an animal welfare person. And I can tell you that pigs don't get pregnant by accident. And so for a fetal pig to be considered a byproduct, to me, a byproduct is like something that would have happened anyway, and we're using it to maximize the use of something or someone. And in this case, the fetal pig that is then channeled into our dissection practices was intentionally created. So I don't really know whether that's fair, but they come from the food production industry nonetheless. Species like rats and frogs are often purpose bred. Dogfish, would be often bycatch from the fishing industry. Sometimes animals are wild caught. So some frogs in the past have been wild caught. And in British Columbia and other places too, wild capture of frogs for dissection has actually greatly impacted wild populations.
And are all of these animals coming from Canada and from these various places, or are they coming from overseas or other countries?
For the purpose-bred ones, they would likely be coming, at the very least, from North America. There are biological supply companies that, like Boreal Northwest or Carolina Broad Scientific, and they supply animal specimens for high school dissections. And every teacher conference that I've been to, every science teacher conference at least, has a representative there from organizations or companies like that. And I have a couple of catalogs sat on my desk, and it's amazing to me that you can just flick through a catalog and order dead animals in that way.
Wow.
Bit of a macabre.
Absolutely. And what percentage of teachers then are catching on to using alternatives? Is this a straightforward thing? Are you having a lot of success getting teachers to come on board with this?
So what I'll say is that we learned in our survey that 79% of teachers still do dissection in their classrooms in BC.
That's quite high.
It is quite high. I can't tell you whether that's representative of other provinces, because education is managed provincially in Canada, but hopefully in the future, either our organization or somebody else will do those surveys so we get a better handle on the data.
So why is that the case? Why are those numbers still so high, given all of these reasons? Like, it just seems to make sense to switch over.
Yeah, so what we learned was that actually a majority of teachers would be very willing to switch to alternatives, and we asked them about what the barriers would be then. And the greatest barrier for teachers is the lack of time to research the alternatives for themselves. And so that's where our organization comes in, because we can actually take on that burden. And we've done a whole bunch of research into which of the alternatives, there are hundreds of different alternatives for high school dissection, so teachers can use non-animal methods.
I was just looking at your non-animal alternatives database, and it is so amazing. Like, I just can't even believe something like that exists. It's just so easy now for teachers. So if only they could somehow know about this and be directed to your page.
Hopefully through your podcast, some people will learn about it. We're doing our best to kind of grow as an organization and get our, you know, help teachers become aware.
So just for listeners, so they know what this is, you actually have a page on your website. You have a database where if you're a grade 7 teacher and you're used to using frogs in the classroom, dead frogs, if you don't want to do that and you're hearing this podcast and you just don't know how you could possibly implement something new, you can literally go to Animals and Science Policy Institute, to your website, check out the non-animal alternatives database, and you will point the teacher directly to what they need to do for interactive or virtual dissections. And all they need to do is just arrange it there. It's actually very straightforward, and you have this, it's so comprehensive. So if the teacher is interested in using a starfish or a rat or a feudal pig, they can get everything that they need that way.
They can. The other option is, if even if teachers don't want to do that, you can, if you're in British Columbia, book us, and we will just come to your classroom and give the class for you. And we'll bring all of the stuff that we have. We've amassed a lot of these different alternatives, and we've put together a guest class program so that you will come into schools and do the class on behalf of the teacher or with them, whatever they want.
That's absolutely phenomenal. Are you doing this in other provinces as well? I feel like this needs to be expanded countrywide. Worldwide,
I think so too. At the moment, we are an extremely small staff team, and our central office for the charity, our only office, is in Vancouver. Like I said, we only got our charitable status in 2017, but as we grow as an organization, we really are hoping to expand the guest class program to other provinces. If it turns out that we can't do that because it's not feasible, the other option for teachers is to actually download our guest class plans for free, and they'll be going on to our website very soon. We're also translating them into French, Mandarin, and Punjabi to increase accessibility across the country. And we just received funding from Lush Cosmetics to do an educational webinar series, so that we'll be able to show teachers in webinar format how to implement some of the alternatives into their classes. So fear not if you are not a teacher in British Columbia.
That's amazing. I just was wanting to ask you, I also noticed your student choice policy form on the website. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about students right now who are, you know, have dissection as part of their program, but don't want to dissect. What is that situation like now? Because I'm in my mid-40s. So I was reflecting back when I was young, and I remember feeling very forced into dissection or needing to drop my science class, which I heard from you is now no longer really the case. So what should a student do? Is it easier these days? And, you know, how many classrooms do have this kind of written policy presented to them, this opt-out?
I think that's a great question. You know, your story is one that I find pretty heartbreaking, but also I've heard from many other people who are, you know, adults who went on to just do different things in life because they didn't pass their high school science because they refused to do dissection. For contemporary students who are actually in high school right now, I'm not hearing those stories. I'm not hearing students saying like, well, I'm not able to pass science without doing this. They still do have challenges though. So oftentimes teachers will ask that the student just watch a classmate do the dissection, or they'll give them videos or passive learning tools. And in some cases, videos can teach students really well, but you're still witnessing the cutting up of a dead animal on the video. So it's not really ideal. We've heard from teachers that up to 25% of students are asking to opt out of dissection.
So that's pretty high. Right.
Sure. And that's an up to 25%. That was, you know, it could be anywhere between like 0 and 25. It's not a zero. I know that it's not zero, but
I think that you're right. I was reading somewhere in the materials you sent me in preparation, a lot more students probably just do it and they don't want to, but they feel very pressured to do it in order to continue on.
Yeah.
And that's just as terrible, really.
I think it is. And I think that, you know, when it's something that is in violation of an ethical, religious, cultural, or personal barrier for somebody, it's actually a civil liberties issue to give students the right to choose how they want to learn this material. And so a student choice policy upholds that civil liberty. It says, you know what, your teacher is going to give you a free choice between a non-animal teaching method and doing the dissection. And you get to choose for yourself what works for you. So I think that's a very empowering position to put students in, when really the current status quo is that they don't have any power in this decision. If they want to opt out, the burden is squarely on the shoulders of the student to have the courage to say to their teacher, I don't want to do this. But then because of that power imbalance, that's very hard for students to do. And this shifts that, a student choice policy shifts that power balance a little bit. The one thing I'll say is that in British Columbia, there are 60 school districts. 4 currently have existing student choice policies in place. We got a policy win in North Vancouver last year, and their policy will be the 5th, and that's coming very soon, probably by the fall this year. And we also spoke with the Minister of Education because we asked him if he would be willing to mandate that all school districts in the province have a student choice policy in place. Many people have asked me why our organization is not lobbying for a ban on dissection completely, because that's our goal. Our goal is to end dissection. Mm-hmm. The reason that we aren't doing that currently is because there is no policy mechanism that exists for us to exploit to be able to do that. So the Minister of Education can't tell teachers what teaching methods to use. He can't be prescriptive. So the top-down policy mechanism doesn't exist. Like if we said to the minister, we want a ban on dissection in the province, he would very likely say, that's not my job. And so because teachers have a collective bargaining agreement, which means that no one can tell them basically how to do their jobs, there are learning goals that are set out in the BC curriculum, and it's at teacher discretion how they help the students meet those goals.
Ideally, are you looking into, or would you want this kind of a policy to be put in place? Some sort of like animal welfare legislation that would make it prescriptive that teachers don't have the option to use dissection in the classroom.
Right. That's where the situation in Canada gets quite complicated, because we don't have federal legislation here for the use of animals in science at all. And so the Canadian Council on Animal Care, which is the oversight agency that we do have, they set guidelines for the country. But as I said, they don't oversee high schools. Now, one option would be to basically lobby for federal legislation for animals in science. And one provision in that federal legislation would be that no one in Canada can use animals for dissection in high schools anymore. Mm-hmm. And it actually is consistent with the ethics of using animals in science. It's consistent with the principle of replacement. So it's not anything that should be alien to anybody, because we can meet our educational goals without using animals. And so to have that hard line drawn in the sand, I think that line is already drawn. It's just that people don't, like, teachers don't know about the 3 R's. We don't have any policy mechanisms to get bans on dissection. So it's kind of messy.
Having a student choice policy, that it's great and it's wonderful and everything. But I think with very young children, if this is happening, you know, in grade 5 and earlier at times, even in grade 7, children that don't even want to opt out or know they need to opt out necessarily, this is still in their best interest for us to kind of not present this as an option, because it does, I think, inculcate a kind of callousness. What are your views on that?
I wholeheartedly agree. And I'll say it here, but I've said it elsewhere, that when I speak with students who are grades 4-ish, maybe younger, there is a very clear natural compassion and empathy that the students have for animals. And when I ask them about dissection, 100% of those students to date have said that they wouldn't want to do it. They think it's gross. They think it's cruel. They think it's mean. When I ask grade 8s that question, there are a number of the students that think dissection's cool. Their scientific curiosity is piqued by wanting to see the inside of an animal. So I think that we need to hold our science education system accountable for stripping young students of their natural compassion, because that's what dissection does. It teaches them that the right way to do science is to kill animals and take them apart in the name of science. And so when you fast forward to wanting to, you know, find non-animal methods for research and testing, we are battling an ingrained culture of science that has been happening since scientists and researchers were in grade 6.
And it also, I think, extends to how we interact with each other.
100%. I think that one of the biggest things that, you know, I'd love to explore is how no longer offering dissection, but offering humane education actually helps students build empathy, whether that's empathy for animals, whether that's peer-to-peer, becoming a better community member, like tapping into that compassion so that there's less bullying in schools. So, you know, I think that dissection is a social justice issue.
I absolutely think so too. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. You're just so full of incredible information. It was really a pleasure to learn from you and speak with you today. Thank you.
You're welcome.